Do you own an annuity, either fixed rate, indexed, or variable? Are you paying high fees and getting low returns? If so, Annuity General would like you to have this free book to learn the pitfalls and mistakes of buying an annuity. The Annuity Do's and Don'ts for Baby Boomers contains the little-known truths about annuities, like how to help reduce your fees and increase retirement income. And it's free. That's right, free. As a bonus, we'll also throw in a free annuity rate report just for calling. We researched over 1,000 annuities and summarized rates and benefits from financially strong insurers. You get Annuity Do's and Don'ts for Baby Boomers and the Annuity Rate Report, both absolutely free for calling Annuity General today. Hurry, supplies are limited. Call now.
800-760-1845. 800-760-1845. 800-760-1845. That's 800-760-1845.
Welcome, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Dave Liu, co-founder of Real 8. We share the stories of struggle and success behind iconic creators responsible for entertainment we love and focus on people who are underrepresented in the traditional entertainment system. By sharing their journey, our hope is to inspire you to support them as well as encourage you to create. Today, we welcome Bao Tran, an amazing filmmaker who was mentored by master action director Corey Yoon. He has worked on films such as Cho Lon, one of Southeast Asia's highest budgeted action blockbusters, and Jackpot, Vietnam's official entry to the 2016 Oscars for Best Foreign Film. Bao likes to joke that his claim to fame is he's one of the only directors that has been censored by the government and recognized by the Oscars for a comedy with poop jokes. I think those are pretty admirable. His first directorial debut was The Paper Tigers, which was praised by Variety and the New York Times. On Rotten Tomatoes, the film is ranked as one of the best action comedies and Asian American movies ever, and has one of the highest rankings ever at 98%. Personally, I love the film, and it really resonated with me because the lead characters are all people of color who are middle-aged and out of shape, just like me. It also reminded me of the humor and heart of The Karate Kid, which I loved as a kid. Welcome, Bao. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Dave. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. So like every great franchise film, let's start with your origin story. You said publicly that your family originally came from Vietnam with the fall of Saigon and immigrated here to the U.S. Tell me a little bit more about your family journey and how your heritage influenced who you became.
Well, as you mentioned, my family came post-Vietnam War, I guess, after the fall of Saigon. In the late 70s, we came to the States, and I was the you would say the first of my generation to be born here in America. So depending on scholars, you know, no one has been able to really pin down definition for me, whether this first generation 1.5 or 2, but I don't know what it all means. But the point is, I was the first of my family to be born here in the States. And so that was kind of an interesting upbringing because you had older siblings that, you know, were born in Vietnam, but also are, you know, starting to acclimatize themselves to here in the States, and it'll speak English fluently. And then you also have parents that are, you know, working class, but also, you know, trying to learn English essentially as a second language. You know, the courses were called ESL at that time.
We'll be back right after this.
Remember your favorite movie moments? Ever thought about collecting them and connecting with your favorite creators? Now you can turn that wish into a reality with Real 8. Real 8 is an inaugural NFT marketplace for fans to collect exclusive behind-the-scenes moments. With Real 8, you can access unique experiences like meeting the cast and crew live. Visit real8.com/USA now to join a community of like-minded fans and get even closer to the films you love. Don't miss the latest NFT drop. Check out real8.com/USA. That's R-E-E-L, the number 8.com/USA.
Blue Chew is a unique online service that delivers the same active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis, but in chewable form and at a fraction of the cost. Blue Chew's tablets combat all forms of ED and can help men gain extra confidence when it's time to perform. No visits to the doctor, no awkward conversations, and no waiting in line at the pharmacy, and it ships right to your door. The process is simple. Sign up at BlueChew.com. Consult with one of their licensed medical providers, and once you're approved, you'll receive your prescription within days. Blue Chew's licensed medical providers work with you to find the right prescription. Blue Chew's tablets are chewable. and they're made in the USA. They prepare and ship directly, so it's cheaper than a pharmacy. Plus, there's a special deal for our listeners. Try Blue Chew free when you use our promo code SPORTS at checkout. Just pay $5 shipping. That's BlueChew.com, promo code SPORTS, to receive your first month free.
Angie's List is now Angie, your home for everything home. With Angie, you could cross your next project off your to-do list before this ad is over. Just tell us what you need and we'll handle the rest, sending a top pro to get it done. Or browse reviews, compare quotes from pros, and connect instantly, all for free. For everything from routine maintenance to a dream remodel, because however you want your project done, we'll get it done. Download the app or go to Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com to get started.
Are you looking to start a business? From side hustles to major business opportunity? Franchise 123 connects franchise buyers with sellers. And we have over 4,000 franchises for you to choose from. In one simple 30-second call, our live agents will sign you up to the platform. This is not a hard sales call either. We give you free access to our database. Yes, free access, no cost. We are the largest online franchise database in the world. You can find 95% of all businesses. Buying a franchise doesn't have to be complicated. We make it easy. And right now, some have no startup fees. You can turn your special skill into a franchise business or go full scale with all the top franchise businesses in the world. Sign up with Franchise 123 now and get your free guide to franchise success now. Call 800-433-0539, 800-433-0539, or text Franchise 123 to 63566. Text Franchise 123 to 63566.
Welcome, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Dave Liu, co-founder of Real 8. Today, we welcome Bao Tran, an amazing filmmaker who was mentored by master action director Corey Yuen. And what did your parents do in Vietnam and then here in the U.S.?
My father was like a professor. He was a teacher of English and linguistics in school. I think it was like secondary school, what you call, you know, high school. He basically, you know, was able to kind of like have an English foundation when he came to the States, and then helped get the family, you know, its footing, at least with an English background. That helped a lot. But he ended up working as a janitor when he was in the States. You know, he already started working on very blue collar jobs to kind of support his family. So that's something that very much kind of seared in your head if you're a child. This type of immigrant experience of basically having your hopes and dreams, you know, dashed by national politics and world events. And is that anything new, you know, now in this day and age? But it's a very common thing. But you think about, you know, he was probably about 38, 37, late 30s when he eventually moved his family here. So you think about those chapters in your life. You know, how much have you developed and establish yourself and build a career and build your family at that age, and suddenly to have it all pick up and start all over again is very, very dramatic, and traumatic, I'm sure. So those are kind of like an interesting questions that we always kind of grow up with and kind of have that weight, a burden of responsibility, if we will, for better or worse, to kind of like make those sacrifices worthwhile and live up to the things that your family had given out for you to be able to achieve.
So how did that impact kind of your thinking about your career and what you want to do with your life when you see your father, who is probably the person that you look up most to, at least as a male figure, had to go through this pretty drastic change in his career and his life from a very well-respected teacher, professor, to a janitor, which is a really humbling job. How did that impact you, and how did that affect the way you thought about what you wanted to do with your life?
Yeah, at the very least, maybe from an early age, you kind of like throw out those class distinctions and any of those ideas, high or low or anything. It's really about people who are working hard and sacrificing and supporting for the family. So you start to, everyone you meet, you have to kind of like, give them that same dignity and that same respect that, you know, you would want to be received from others, from other strangers. So that kind of like is that basic decency, you know, was instilled very early on, and you kind of have that. And, you know, nobody's too high to be too high. Nobody's low to be too low, if that makes sense. And so everybody's on the same playing field, and we treat each other with respect. So that's kind of the starting point. And obviously with all the sacrifice and the hard work and the ethic, you know, we all, Asian parents, you know, have, you know, a certain reputation for having a certain work ethic and all those things. Very, I would say, survivor-based, very practical, very utilitarian. Like, think about, you know, what it needs, you know, what can be achieved out of these things. And unfortunately, you know, the arts kind of takes a back seat to that. And so for me, you know, I always grew up writing and like listening to music. You know, I was always engaged in arts and culture, whether it was like Vietnamese or Asian or American pop music or whatever. Like, that was all stuff that I really started taking to. You know, I wasn't a STEM guy. You know, I wasn't really a math guy in particularly. And so all those things were, yeah, I have to do it, and then almost kind of like do it by brute force. And I did okay. But, you know, in terms of like what, you know, made you happy or the things that you like to do in your free time, it was definitely arts and culture, movies in particularly, and stories. So, you know, I was kind of that, I don't want to say the odd duck or the black sheep in that sense, but, you know, I had different sensibilities than say other in my family, but that's not to say Vietnamese are very passionate about, passionate people. You know, they play music, you know, and, you know, any dinner setting or any vacation or camping, we all have like incredible musical memories and playing together and jamming. So it's very much part of the culture, but the connect of being able to say, I can do this for a living is different. Like, there is a bit of a switch. Like, it's okay. Obviously we all play piano and violin. We all have, like, we all served our time, right? Our conscriptment time, doing piano and violin. But, you know, there's a bit of a divide about what arts and culture means. Like, it's kind of in a box versus like, this is something that we can learn to be better human beings and teach us to be better and grow. And that's kind of like, I think it comes from the survivor mentality, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with it, but, you know, it's just from a certain time and period where maybe, you know, the doors have opened and we don't have to have those same concerns.
Yeah, no, I totally resonate with that. And I've heard similar kind of upbringing from other, particularly Asian American families who are, first generation here, where the family sacrificed a lot. In your case, obviously came from a war-torn country, and the parents really want their kids to have very stable, safe jobs, and they don't necessarily want them to go into careers like arts where there's a high variability in terms of your ability to make a living or not. So when you were growing up,
just to underline that, and yet we express, consume, like, that's a funky word that I always feel weird about. We express, consume art all the time. Like I said, like poetry and like talk about like the refugee experience. There's incredible sadness and loss. And there's a great swath of music that was written by Vietnamese American musicians at that time. And, you know, people would sing it in community and together with each other. Like, it's part of that life. And yet again, that connection of like to actually make it as a lifestyle or a career choice, you know, that is that gap. And yet, but we all partake, you know, we're not Quakers. We're not like super, like, you're not Puritans about like art or anything. It's very much part of our lives, art and music and all these things. But that disconnect of saying my kid too can do this, or my, you know, that's something that our family tree can perhaps be a part of. That is where it's kind of like, is that disconnect, if that makes sense.
No, totally. So when you were growing up, kind of in your middle school, high school period, I understand you grew up in Washington. Were you one of the only Asian kids, or was there a lot of diversity in your class?
Depends. I think there were a lot of Vietnamese. There are two chapters. I grew up in Olympia, Washington, which is kind of like the capital city of Washington State, but also because we had our family, my uncles, their sponsor family. So, you know, all those communities kind of like brought the immigrants closer together, because, you know, you had the sponsor. So that there's kind of that chain migration where all the families were able to kind of build community through that. So we weren't dropped in as strangers. We knew each other. We knew this person or that person. So there was definitely that. And then, oh, this person goes to that school, and oh, they're in that school district. But so we always have like Vietnamese events, for example, like weekend Vietnamese language schools was a big thing for the community to be able to support. and have their kids like be tutored and start learning, you know, the rudimentaries of Vietnamese language, reading, writing, and spelling, and all that stuff. And so we did kind of like have that experience, but also we saw each other at school. Sometimes socially they were together, sometimes they hung out, you know, sometimes they didn't. And it just kind of worked out. There was a kind of also some complicated identity issues around that, I'm sure, for a lot of folks. But, you know, for me, when I moved to Seattle, like I had a lot more Asian friends as a whole that weren't necessarily Vietnamese. They were Korean and Chinese and Japanese and Filipino. And so, you know, that in terms of the bigger experience of what the Asian American experience was something that maybe resonated more to me, or just something that we had something in common. We may not speak the same language, but we all kind of felt the same issues of trying to find friends that looked at like us and understood our values and cultures in some sense.
You'd been working on a film. You effectively mm-hmm. had it in the can. Mm-hmm. And that was when you revealed to your parents, hey, I think I want to give this a go. And by the way, here's a finished film that I made.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was, it was VC, it's Visual Communications at LA, Los Angeles Asian Pacific Film Festival. And they had my short film. And they, you know, I basically got a letter of acceptance or something. Yeah, you know, basically I had a screening. I was programmed for the festival. So I definitely had this bird in hand. And, you know, be able to kind of tell your family that I make movies, but also people like it and people want to show it. And so you kind of have that, you know, in your back pocket. So yeah, that was kind of the whole process. I wanted to wait till graduation because really there wasn't to be said to me until then, to be honest, because I knew I had to get a degree. And that was just kind of family understanding to have a degree and have a, even as a fallback career and then have something that you can have that stable. If I were to be dropped out of college or, you know, didn't even start college, then I think that would have been a huge issue. So to me, I kind of played the long game and said, I'll do this 4 years, hunker down for 4 years and try to get this computer science degree, no less, and graduate in that, but also try to make some inroads into filmmaking.
Did your parents or your family watch the film?
Yeah, they liked it. Yeah, I mean, it all worked out, but there's always questions like, yeah, it's cool, but, you know, can you make a career of it? You know, and those are all the gnawing questions. So, you know, that to me is what I started to really kind of start to understand. It wasn't necessarily, you know, against the arts or anything like that. It was just kind of like, well, what can you make of it? Because the challenge with Asian American families, and I'll just speak broadly, is like there's not a support system for anyone that wants to go into the arts. You know, for Asian Americans, Vietnamese in particular, you know, you can go into pharmacy, pretty well-established career path for a lot of Vietnamese Americans. But also think of the support network. So if I told my family I wanted to be a pharmacist, my family can find out from Uncle Bob or Aunt Susie, you know, or all those things and try to figure out like, hey, what's a good career school? What's a good track for Bao? You know, how could we figure out, can you ask favors and all these things and can help you tutor and all those things you can do? You can figure out all those things. But if you say, I want to be in movies or be an artist, most parents don't have the tools to be able to help in that way. And so then that's when I started to understand it was just more out of frustration of not being able to help. It wasn't for lack of support. It's just they didn't know how to support. And so I think that's been always kind of that tension or that kind of like difficulty of understanding, almost like kind of like trusting that your child can kind of go down this career path.
We'll be back right after this.
I am a non-attorney spokesperson representing a team of lawyers who've helped people that have been injured or wronged. If you've had a revision or removal surgery of a hernia mesh implant after 2008, pay close attention to this message. Hernia mesh manufacturers have recalled some of the mesh material that may have been used in your surgery due to high failure rate. The FDA has even blamed the recalled mesh material for some of the worst of the health issues reported by doctors and patients. If you've had two or more hernia surgeries for the same issue and you're having severe complications, call the legal helpline now. You could receive a free cash award and have your medical expenses covered. And there's no upfront cost to you. They only get paid if you win. So please call now.
800-817-2968. 800-817-2968. 800-817-2968. That's 800-817-2968.
I'm going to tell you how you can get real healthcare for as little as $6 a day. Yes, now you can get affordable healthcare for you and your family immediately and save as much as 50% off your current monthly healthcare payments. Our plans are perfect for people that are self-employed, can't afford health benefits where they work, or just want to pay less for their current healthcare. And coverage is guaranteed regardless of your medical condition. We even offer some of the new Christian faith-based health benefits. Save up to 50% on your family's health care. Make a free quick call now. There are no contracts, and we give you a 10-day money-back trial period. Call Provision Enrollment right now for your risk-free guaranteed health insurance quote starting at $6 a day.
800-472-5145. 800-472-5145. That's 800-472-5145.
Come on, you watch the news. Be prepared to pay more taxes. Then if you owe back taxes or haven't filed in a few years, get ready. The IRS, the largest collection agency in the world, will be coming after you. With the power to collect taxes by any means they want to. Hey, they can freeze your bank account, your passport, even padlock your business. Oh, good times. Look, if the IRS claims you owe them $5,000 or more in back taxes and they're coming after you, don't panic. Call my friends at Get a Tax Lawyer first. Their job is to negotiate with the IRS and save you money. They're experts at it. That's all they do. And you can trust them. In some cases, they have reduced a $50,000 tax bill to less than $1,000. If you owe the IRS $5,000 or more in back taxes, call now for a free consultation.
Call 800-732-9635. 800-732-9635. 800-732-9635. That's 800-732-9635.
Welcome, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Dave Liu, co-founder of Real 8. Let's just flash forward a little here. So what are your parents or your family's reactions now to your path as a career as a filmmaker?
I was fine now. Yeah, I think what I think post-college, that was probably the toughest time because I think they wanted to see something that was tangible and that, like, you know, that I didn't just sit down and daydream about it, but actually go out and try it. But now they've seen me hustle and they've seen me work really hard. And so that's not the question. There is still, you know, anxiety about how this is going to pan out or how the movie did and how, you know, box office and what success means. And you have to kind of like coach them through and help them understand, you know, what it means in this landscape to have a successful film, which could mean a lot of things. And so, you know, those are always the conversations. It's just, they just don't know. And I think, you know, I think the difference, like you say, you're asking is basically for me to kind of help communicate and understand where they're coming from. And, you know, hopefully I can try to express those things, but they're very happy. I mean, they love the film that's never been the question. It's just, you know, how exactly does this translate into security?
Right. Right. So, well, hopefully they're really proud of you because you've made some amazing work since then.
They're good.
So let's go back in time here. So you've said that, you watched a lot of film, growing up, and you unpacked a lot of that in order to learn how to make film. Maybe you can just give us a little more color on how you transitioned from being a fan of film to really a student of film, because there's a lot of us who watch a lot of film. I certainly watch a lot of film, but I don't know 2 cents about like how to make a film. So maybe you can just give us a sense of how you made that transition as you were becoming a filmmaker.
Yeah, I would say, again, just to kind of set the scene, to have a video camera is really groundbreaking. And by that, I mean a video camcorder, not necessarily a Super 8 camera or anything, which is all great. But, you know, for some cosmic circumstance, you know, I was born in this time where this thing was just starting to come with technology. And so I think that technology was a huge way for me to kind of like jump into that. And maybe we take it all for granted now with cell phones that take videos and, you know, you can edit and stitch and do everything on your cell phone. But imagine a time where there was a barrier of entry to even make films because you had to get the stock and you had to go film. And so it's very expensive. And the whole prospect of going to film school is, you know, very daunting. So that, I'm just saying that just to set the scene. And so for me to be able to even have an inkling or a spark of an idea that I could even make it, started essentially with videotapes, essentially with TV and watching, going to Chinatown and Asian mom and pop shops and getting these videotapes or sharing videotapes with family members and swapping. You know, we'd have these all these movies and TV shows that were from Asia. And that was kind of our lifeline to Asian culture and be able to watch this together as a family and see movies and the latest, entertainment that was going on, you know, across the ocean. And so I was watching all that stuff growing up, Bruce Lee especially, you know, huge Bruce Lee fan, and very much like you, like watching it as a fan and just being enamored. And so for me, Bruce Lee was definitely as an image of a movie star, but it wasn't anything that was like I could do it or that I could try to like, you know, figure out what he was doing. He was just so much of a comet. You know what I mean? You can't catch that comet. Actually, it wasn't until I started seeing Jackie Chan. For some reason, just some light bulb turned on for me, because he has a certain type of filmmaking style, or it's very tangible. The way the rhythm he uses, the choreography, it's just a very musical, accessible thing. And I just really was fascinated by that, because I just wanted to start to tinker, you know, underneath the hood. How does it all work? How does the cut work? How does the framing work? Because he just had the perfect like concept of filmmaking, not just martial arts ability, which is fantastic, but the filmmaking and shooting and editing of that was so fascinating to me. So I don't know what it was. It was just musical to me. It was like music to my ears, literally. If you close your eyes and watch his movies, you can hear the sound effects, and there's a certain tempo and a rhythm to all that. So yeah, that's when I started to kind of like really want to understand what that means. And because of that, you know, you had a VHS deck, you could pause it, you could record it and dub it and watch it again. Just go slow-mo frame by frame. You could do all these things now just in sitting at home if you just know how to use your VCR. And so that's how I started to learn how to make films, is actually, you know, filming on my camcorder and then editing between two VHS decks. And you start to kind of like figure out how the wires, all those, you know, whatever, all that, yellow and red cables, all that means in the back, and you start to figure all those things. It was very much self-taught.
So you've also mentioned publicly that you had Corey Yoon as your mentor, and he had an influence on your early career and also your art. Maybe for the audience, you can tell us a little bit about who he is and how he influenced you.
Yes, Corey is a legend. He is one of the, pioneers or legends of Hong Kong cinema, especially if you're aware of that history of the Hong Kong cinema kind of has this great trademark of action films. And that's where Jackie Chan and Bruce Lee came from. So he's also one of the great directors in that period to come out of that. And so he actually grew up with Jackie Chan. So Jackie Chan and Corey had grew up in what's called a Peking Opera School, which is almost like a circus, a martial arts circus, performing circus. And they learned from an early age how to flip, how to tumble, do martial arts, sing, dance. That's very much like all the nines on that one. So they learned how to do all these things from a very early age and converted that into filmmaking. So now this generation of Jackie Chan and Corey and also Sammo Hung and like just a legendary group of filmmakers who, you know, were able to, you know, basically make something out of that. And so Corey was a huge influence. He's actually, you know, a family friend from high school. So that's how I got to know him. And so when I was making, again, these backyard videos, he was, you know, sit down and watch and give me feedback and give me, you know, like things to look out for, things to think about, you know, and, you know, kind of tear it apart, to be honest, and just like give me the goods about what I needed to know and like really set my path, because he was making movies that were international release, you know. And so I was thinking, he got me started to think about what it means for the world audience and what that means, how to engage with people who don't know you. It's one thing to show your backyard video to your friends and everyone laughing and like, but you got to show it to people who don't know. And so again, this is before YouTube, and you know, maybe this is old fashioned, but you know, this is before YouTube and not having that sense that what you put up can be seen by everyone around the world. And that was not in our purview at that time. And to actually kind of like open my mind up to that was huge. And you start thinking about storytelling and all those things. And then again, going down the study of the craft, but Corey's a legend in that sense. You know, he's, you know, just kind of backing up. If you've seen The Transporter, he basically blew open the doors for Jason Statham and Michelle Yeoh and Jet Li and Stephen Chow. And so Van Damme, right? So, I mean, he's a legendary filmmaker. So, you know, it was a strange set of circumstances for me to, again, not have any movie ties, not know anything, fall in love with action movies, specifically Hong Kong action movies, and to be able to cross, you know, paths in this universe with Corey is incredible.
And so how did he influenced you? Did he actually take you under his wing and say, hey, this is how you do a great fight scene. This is how you film a fight scene. I also understand that you are a martial artist. Did he have an influence on that? Maybe you can just give a little bit more color on what were some examples of how he helped you as a filmmaker.
I think first and foremost, just by example, just the fact that he was able to incredibly busy, incredibly prolific filmmaker to be able to sit down and watch my stupid videos and give me tips and actually tell me, you know, what to fix and what to do and all those things. So just the fact of that example, that he would made the time and space for me, you know, I can't thank him enough. I mean, that's an incredible experience to have as a young person or any person, you know, to have. So that's the first and foremost. And particularly the specifically filmmaking, yes, the stuff that you said, kind of breaking down fight sequences, understanding what an action scene is. An action scene is really a storytelling scene. It's really a drama scene. You know, it's not about the moves, it's about what's going on with the characters. And that started kind of like opening my eyes in terms of what filmmaking was and what's engaging with an audience is. And really evaluating the importance of story, first and foremost, because if you can't have good action if you don't have a good story. That's something that, you know, you would always say. And so you always want to look for the story first and then build the action around that. So that's kind of a different way, or just kind of like something, sorry, it's common sense. Maybe it's not very common and simple, but it was very something that I didn't really come to think of until he brought that out. And so, yeah, once you have that light bulb moment, it's hard to say what was the most influential, because that opens the whole door to all this exploration and learning and a way of seeing the world. So to me, it's like that was that first seed that just changed everything.
We'll be back right after this.
Remember your favorite movie moments? Ever thought about collecting them and connecting with your favorite creators? Now you can turn that wish into a reality with Real 8. Real 8 is an inaugural NFT marketplace for fans to collect exclusive behind-the-scenes moments. With Real 8, you can access unique experiences like meeting the cast and crew live. Visit real8.com/USA now to join a community of like-minded fans and get even closer to the films you love. Don't miss the latest NFT drop. Check out real8.com/USA. That's R-E-E-L, the number 8.com/USA.
I need a laptop that helps me work remote from Charleston, or Charlotte, or wherever I am this week.
It's possible at Staples.
How about a PC that can manage my workload at a price I can manage?
Also possible. Your local Staples store has the innovative tech and tools you need to take on the future of work. And this week at Staples, you can save up to $230 on select PCs. Explore what's new for your business at Staples, the working and learning store. Ends 3/19. Limit 2, in-store only.
Right now, sports betting is the fastest growing industry in the world. To consistently cash tickets at the sports books, it's best to be armed with the right plays from the best sports bettors in the business. That's what you'll get at AgainstTheNumber.com. At AgainstTheNumber.com, you'll get specialists with decades of experience betting multiple sports at a high level and many sports-specific packages, from the NFL to college basketball to cricket to soccer to the European Tour, that gives you a consistent edge on the sportsbook. For a highly skilled, reasonably priced team of premium sports handicappers focused on one thing and one thing only, beating the books at their own game. Visit againstthenumber.com.
That's againstthenumber.com.
Fever is the leading symptom of COVID and the flu, and the only way to reliably detect fever is with an accurate thermometer. Be vigilant and be accurate with the Exergen Temporal Scanner, proven in more than 100 clinical studies. Don't rely on non-contact thermometers. They are proven to be inaccurate and will not reliably detect a fever that might mean COVID. Be sure to seek medical advice at the first sign of fever. Learn more at Exergen.com.
Hi, Tom Baudet for Motel 6, and we'll leave the light on for fur babies. If you think it's been hard being stuck at home for a year, think about your dog. It's been 7 years for them, and they deserve to get out and sniff the world too. So grab Daisy, Ranger, or Doodles and hit the road. But be sure to stick your head out the window and look for a Motel 6. And like all pets, Baxter stays free. Hot dog. I'm Tom Baudet for Motel 6, and we'll leave the light on for you.
Welcome, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Dave Liu, co-founder of Real 8. So let's talk a little bit about your claim to fame, the film that has really put you on the map, The Paper Tigers. So I really love the film. I think it's a must-watch for anyone, particularly Asian-American families. Can you talk a little bit about what was the inspiration for the film?
Yeah, so you mentioned, this project that I worked on in Vietnam that was basically banned. So that was kind of I'll just kind of like give the broad strokes on this. But after I finished college, I was starting to make my own films. A lot of my peers that I met through film festivals that were Asian American, specifically Vietnamese American, were in Vietnam and starting their own films and kind of getting their film careers off the ground. And so I came out for a couple projects to help edit their films, and those films got released in the theaters in Vietnam. One of them got banned actually because of censorship. In Vietnam, there's a very strict censorship board, so you have to kind of like pass through to get permission to even show your film. So all those things happened. We worked really hard on this film. It was a big bummer, very disappointed. Like all of us were pretty devastated, to be honest, about that. And so at that time, I was feeling kind of burnt out, you know, making films, you know, having this passion and just have the rug pulled out under you is just like pretty devastating. So I already had this idea that I was about these guys that were just trying to discover their mojo and get their groove back and in a martial arts setting, just as an idea. And I just started really polishing that idea and started figuring out, you know, what that meant thematically to me. Cause like, if you ask inspiration, it was just the feeling of like being burnt out, not quite being in love with the things that you were passionate about once before. And what is that feeling? And I started just kind of like use that as fodder to kind of come up with the idea for The Paper Tigers, which is about these three martial artists who kind of like, go their separate ways, but they discover, you know, the roots and the relationships with each other. So this is really just a story of rediscovery. And so that's kind of like what set it on its way for that.
So let me just understand what was going on over this 10-year period. Unless you were born wealthy or hit the lottery, which I'm pretty sure it didn't happen, you were still trying to make a living. And then you also were trying to raise money, and you were also trying to make the film. So you were essentially triple processing during this 10-year period. Is that correct?
Triple or quadruple or quintuple, whatever processing. It was a lot. I think, it was a lot of multitasking and also kind of planning. I think maybe that's kind of where the savviness of being a freelance filmmaker kind of came in. It is basically feast or famine. And so you have to like learn how to kind of earn and save and keep your money and make sure it's all kind of like there for you. But not knowing when the movie was going to get made, because anytime you got the green light, you know, you better scramble and run and make it happen. So that's kind of it's almost like a 10-year holding pattern, but you know, your engines are revving so hard and you're just like redlining and you're going out still hustling and trying to get the money. It's not, but instead, if this is a holding pattern, you know, like, you know, I can't wait for the race, because it was like that type of pace. And it's not very hard to liken it to anything, but like you were saying, triple processing, you know, is as apt as any, because it was definitely feel like we weren't just sitting around waiting for an opportunity to happen. We were trying to find, you know, ways to do it, but also like it wasn't on paper, it wasn't moving anywhere fast, if that makes sense, you know? And so that's a very hard place to be psychologically, to be honest, but it's a testament to my team, you know, our producing team. We have this legendary, I guess now legendary calls. We literally have weekly calls every week to check in, check on progress, check on each other, and just figure out the action items for the week, even though, you know, bank account was the same and we weren't getting, you know, any traction, you know, for months or years on end even. And yet we still kept at it. This was a monthly ritualized regular call that we had. And it was a way for me, at least, you can speak for them. Maybe they have their own trauma stories to tell about the story, because, you know, they had, fortunately for them and for me, you know, I didn't have much, you know, I'm a single person. So they had families and, you know, they had to juggle a lot of those things. But speaking for myself, having these calls of checking in was really important, because it makes it feel real. You know, if you would just say, hello, checking on email, let me follow up this and how's this going and how's that going? It doesn't feel real unless you actually sit there and talk about and plan and have a game plan. It may be a dead end or may not come out to anything, but, you know, imagine 10 years of that.
So now that the film is done, what are you most proud of from that film. I've actually seen some blogs about some of the philosophical lessons from the film.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was part of your intent or not, but
it's all intended.
This is why
that's
I
what
say
a genius
it's great.
Does.
Yeah, exactly. just take the credit.
Yeah, exactly.
But there's a lot of great stuff in there for families. So that's why I think that I highly recommend it to Asian American families or all families to watch. But how do you think about the key lessons or takeaways from the film?
Yeah, I'll just, kind of do a summary of all the feelings because we went through all the emotions, in terms of releasing the film. So I'll start with a high. I think it was really great to be able to release a film and have a distribution deal and have like a theatrical release in the midst of COVID with, 50% theater capacity or 25% if even. And so for our distributor to kind of like believe in our film and want to put it out there in this landscape, was very, very moving because it's like they believe in the film and then, they're hustling in the same way that we had been hustling all the way up to now. So to have other supporters and your team be on the same page, that was great. To release in the middle of COVID, obviously is very challenging, but you start to engage an audience in different ways. Like with you yourself, for example, like a lot of folks had seen it on streaming or VOD, and then you get feedback kind of randomly, either on social media or email. So it's a little bit kind of a delayed effect, but people actually are able to sit down and write how they feel about the film to you, which is great. So the difference is like if you're in a theater, everybody's laughing. And after the screening, everyone kind of comes up to you and, tells you what they feel about the film. So it's a little bit like, a little bit more immediate gratification. But at least with this, people see it, sit at home, think about it, actually take the time to compose an email. In this day and age, look how much energy it takes for anyone to write an email. And that's incredible. And then that kind of like cracks through the noise, if you will. And you really start to kind of take all these messages, with a lot more weight in that sense. The middling is interesting. I would say the middling is obviously COVID is always the kick in the pants and just trying to struggle and deal with all that, and then dealing with the bigger studio pictures because you're competing with them because everybody's been on a backlog. And so the differences and the gap, if you will, between rich and poor is like even bigger, right? The gap between a high budget film and a low budget film is even bigger. The marketing and the push and just like the signal to noise ratio, getting people to be aware of it, it just becomes, even more difficult. And so that was kind of a learning experience for all of us, but it was like, it's one of those, it is what it is. And, we just have to kind of like roll with punches. The lows is kind of get back in verse. I would say the lows is just the fact that we just haven't really had the opportunity to be able to really sit a proper crowd and watch this movie with a good audience. And because that at the end of the day is what we wanted to make the movie for an audience to have a great Friday night, great Saturday night, and to laugh and cry with strangers in the dark. I mean, that to me is what movies are. And so we have some great experiences, mind you. Everyone's tried their best. This is no knock on anyone, but all the festivals have done drive-in screenings and then try to replicate the physical experience as much as possible. So there's all that. And we did have a theatrical run, but like I said, it was 50% capacity and 25% capacity and so on. And so we just tried to make do. But you just kind of have like that picture in your mind, because I grew up watching Spielberg, Indiana Jones in the theater, and just kind of seeing those big, big movie moments in a crowd is like, that just is the tops, that's the highest of the highest. So that's kind of the sad, but we'll get that eventually. I'm sure we'll have some retrospective and have an opportunity to be able to have that proper theater experience.
So I got to ask, as a fan of the film, would you ever make a sequel? Because I think you've created a pretty cool world with these three middle-aged guys that remind me of me.
Yeah. I mean, these guys are so, the characters are so endearing. And like, that was kind of the fun for me to be able to see the actors take that, bring life to that, because then you start to fall in love with them in a different way, because they're just kind of like ideas or images you have in your mind or on the page. But when your actors come in and fill in all those gaps and fill in the colors, it's incredible. And their chemistry, like you say, is just so, so fun to watch. And so that's been my personal pleasure seeing this. So I am very flattered to hear people, talk about a sequel or just wanting to see this universe and the world or be in that world a little bit more. And so that's great. I don't really have anything in particular at the moment, but yeah, it's definitely great to hear. I do have some, projects of my own that we're trying to, get off the ground. So that those are kind of like also what, trying to keep that grind going as well.
So you're clearly an example of the power of just hard work and sticking with it, particularly against all the odds. And I think that when I hear your story, it's clearly one of threading the needle and being able to get this done. Are there any lessons or thoughts you have in terms of how the system or the environment could be a little bit more welcoming so that the boneyard, as you put it, of great films never made could be smaller? Are there things that you think would make the system a little easier for the other Baltrans out there?
That's an interesting question. I think on the micro, for me, I do what I can to be able to pay it forward. So if anyone, I get a lot of introductions or people come up to me at the screenings and they ask me how, advice about filmmaking or anything like that, any opportunity I have to be able to, keep the trauma or save other people from going through grief, I'm all for. So on the micro and the personal level, those are the things that I can do and those are within my reach. On the bigger level, cultural sea changes and all those things, those are going to be, on all hands on deck type of effort. I think it's going to take, our whole community as Asian Americans or as film lovers or just as a community as a whole, really need to kind of like understand the economics of filmmaking. Is, like I said, it's a very expensive hobby, but the numbers don't often quite kind of return in the same way, or at least let's say the cut of the share doesn't always return in the same way. And so, for example, there's that kind of well-known story out there about Squid Game, the creator of Squid Game, who, created this incredible, phenomenal success for Netflix. But according to the details of the original deals, like the creator was not that financially remunerated. It wasn't as lucrative as you would think for the creator of Squid Game, but it was very lucrative for Netflix, let's put it that way. And so there's a lot of inequities around the movie business and kind of the studio and the creators and all those things. So I think those are kind of bigger questions, but that we all need to start asking and challenging ourselves to be able to do. And, and getting more savvy audience, right? It's not just say, oh, your movie's on Netflix, you're a big hit, you just must be a success now. It's like that doesn't always pan out because the numbers come down to the brass tacks with the numbers. Those aren't the deals that are being made right now. So I think that's something that we just need to all kind of start to understand what the economics and the power of buying a movie ticket, but also the power of supporting creatives are also important as well.
Yeah, particularly for those artists and creators that are telling stories that resonate with you, because I think that that's fundamentally been one of the biggest challenges. You, in many ways, found financing from not Belgian dentists, but Vietnamese doctors in Seattle. And they saw something in your film that executives in Hollywood did not. And so I think that just goes to show the power of finding the right community, the right tribe that resonates with the stories that certain creators are making. And we just got to figure out a more efficient system to make that happen.
Absolutely. I mean, even just speaking anecdotally, everyone feels a disconnect. Like, why are there not Asian American creatives in executive roles? Why aren't there more? Like, the breakdown of what Hollywood is and, say, those people in power, that racial breakdown and gender breakdown does not match the entire demographic of, say, even America, right? And so, not to say that, how to make that happen, but certainly raise questions why that is. And we have to understand kind of like all the, again, the gatekeeping and all those things that are happening and how to kind of break open those doors and to have people be able to have access or be able to create, but also build a community of not just a Belgian dentist and Vietnamese doctors. How do we get all of them, involved and engaged? And I think it's just a greater conversation about engagement with the arts. It's not just there to kind of entertain and be there for us, but, and kind of forget about the value of it and not really understand the money that really goes into making it and all the cost of it. The great reality is kind of like during COVID, obviously everyone during lockdown, we talk about cutting funds for the arts, but then during lockdown, what did we do? We started streaming and we started listening to music and we had all these things that we needed as therapy to help us get through and to entertain ourselves and at least be able to laugh and smile about something. So I think we have, as a greater, this is kind of a bigger rant, but this greater idea of what arts and culture is, it's not disposable. It's really important work.
We'll be back right after this.
Here's a simple solution for you. If you have back pain, knee pain, or any other pain in your body, it's as simple as drinking a glass of water every day. Your body is over 60% water, and drinking the best water you can get is crucial for your health.
Echo Antioxidant Water, developed by Synergy Science, is the best water you can drink, and it's only available through this special radio offer. Over 1,000 research studies have shown that the powerful antioxidant used in Echo Antioxidant Water can reduce inflammation, improve brain function, help you sleep better, and boost gut health. With just 2 glasses a day, you can experience these benefits right from the comfort of your home. Some people have even replaced their morning coffee jolt with Echo Antioxidant Water. Call now and learn which Echo product by Synergy Science is right for you. We offer free shipping and a full 30-day money-back guarantee. Change your health by simply changing your water.
800-944-1789. 800-944-1789. 800-944-1789. That's 800-944-1789.
If you're taking a calcium supplement, it's probably not doing what you think it is. That's because you still lose bone density with traditional calcium supplements. That's where calcium from algae comes in. AlgaeCal Plus doesn't just stop bone loss. It's the only supplement ever shown to increase bone density in clinical studies. That's right. AlgaeCal Plus increases bone density, even if you're in your 80s. That's because your bones need more than just calcium and vitamin D to stay strong. There are actually 13 minerals and 3 vitamins needed to build healthy new bone, and AlgaeCal Plus contains all of them, and it's proudly made in the USA. Your calcium doesn't increase bone density. AlgaeCal Plus does. Talk to one of our bone health consultants today and see how AlgaeCal Plus can start increasing your bone density. Call now.
800-437-8217. 800-437-8217. 800-437-8217. That's 800-437-8217.
Remember your favorite movie moments? Ever thought about collecting them and connecting with your favorite creators? Now you can turn that wish into a reality with Real 8. Real 8 is an inaugural NFT marketplace for fans to collect exclusive behind-the-scenes moments. With Real 8, you can access unique experiences like meeting the cast and crew live. Visit real8.com/USA now to join a community of like-minded fans and get even closer to the films you love. Don't miss the latest NFT drop. Check out real8.com/USA. That's R-E-E-L, the number 8.com/USA.
Welcome, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Dave Liu, co-founder of Real 8. If you think about humanity, thousands of years from now, people won't necessarily remember which companies went public. What they'll remember is the art that was created during this era. And movies and film are another form of amazing art. So with you, aside from potentially working on a sequel to The Paper Tigers, what's next for you? What are you working on, and what do you want people to know you're working on?
Well, I mean, the best way you can do is follow me on the socials, or you can go to my website, bao.direct, and then you can find me on all the social handles. So that I'll put up like all the newest and latest news up there. For me this year, I'll be part of the CBS, or now called the Paramount Directors Initiative, which is a directing lab for directors to be able to transition or move into TV episodic directing. So that's, I'm on the feature side. So this is kind of an exciting new thing to be able to direct for TV. And so this is an opportunity with Paramount to be work with them to be able to direct an episode later this year, hopefully. And hopefully that'll air probably late, you know, a little bit after that.
That sounds great. I'm really looking forward to see what you're going to create. So my last question is actually 2 questions. As a filmmaker, what is your favorite film? And then what's your favorite film as a fan?
Oh, interesting. I almost feel like it's always the same. Like again, this answer kind of changes from day to day. It's almost like your mood. It's almost like, what do you want to have for dinner? This is all just on your taste right now. For me, I think about Aliens a lot. I think about James Cameron's Aliens, both as a filmmaker and as a fan, because it's just a really fun, rip-roaring action movie. But it's also very thoughtful, and it's also thoughtful in terms of like how we treat our prejudice, how we treat our military, and just how we are, like, you know, war crazed or war hungry, and just as relevant in this time as any. It's a very interesting kind of like way into these headier topics, but in a really fun action movie, if that makes sense. And that's kind of the balance that I always kind of look for. You know, I want to be able to say something and tell something about the world, but, you know, make it really fun and make it entertaining as well.
Yeah, and I love the Aliens. I probably prefer the very first one more than all the others.
Yep.
Well, great. Well, thanks again, Mal, for taking the time to chat with us today and share your story of struggle and success. It's an amazing one. And I encourage everybody to watch your film, The Paper Tigers, available right now on Netflix, as well as follow you on your social media. So thanks again, Mal, for taking the time to chat with us today.
Thank you, Dave. It was great chatting.
You're listening to the Sports Byline USA Broadcast Network.